This is Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Embracing Change. Thank you for being with us through this season on The Story of Us. We have a very special episode today where we have invited Charles Bowman's children to come in and talk to us a little bit about their dad and the stories that they would want to share, whatever it is, that just would be kind of a cap on top of the episodes that you have prior listened to. So at this point, most everyone should know at this point that Charles had passed away on, I believe it was the 17th
of September,
which was a Wednesday at around 2 a.m.
in the morning.
And we're just really grateful for what we were able to record here on the podcast that you guys have heard. And I'm just looking forward to the conversation today because it's really great to talk about him. Loved him a lot. And I'm hoping you guys have some funny stories because I've shared. I'm looking over at Jamar and he's kind of got this funny look on his face. Your dad was by far one of the funniest men I have ever met, just because he had such a dry sense of humor. Like, he could just pop it off just in the perfect moments, and he could take something very serious and make you laugh. So I really enjoyed him. But anyway, welcome Jamar and Amber to the podcast.
Thank you.
And of course, Lakrita is with
me. This is a tribute to my husband and to their father as we just continue to walk this journey out.
Yeah.
His death did somewhat come as a surprise to us.
Because
he was in hospice for seven weeks now, but for 8 days, and he came home with more energy, doing more things. Even the hospice people was like, who is this person? And so, you know, our beloved person, Charles Bowman, my husband, their father, you know, I was, you know, diagnosed with cancer in 2010, made a decision to have surgery on, he had prostate cancer, so made a decision to have his prostate removed. And then for 7 years, he was clear of that cancer. And in 2018, it came back with a vengeance. And my husband decided to not do treatment. He said that he was going to walk this out through faith and food and fellowship and fun. And the doctors, he would go to the doctors every 6 months. And the doctor kept saying, why don't you do this? And why don't you do that? And he looked at him and said, didn't we just have that conversation last 6 months ago? And he's like, yeah, Mr. Bowman, we did. He said, I came to get my numbers checked just to see if my food and my fellowship and my faith and my fun is working. And eventually the doctor just, you know, and it did. It began to work. The doctor kept saying, I can't believe your numbers are going down with no treatment. And whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. And I'm telling you, it was amazing all the way up to 2024 when we had our first PET scan, or he had his, it wasn't me. He had his first PET scan, and that's when they found out that the cancer had spread it into his bones. And the doctor was saying to him at that particular time, he would refer him to hospice because he was going to have to be under pain management because it was one of the most excruciating cancers that anyone could have. Mm. And I remember my husband said, okay, I will go to hospice. I will let you refer me to hospice, but I am not taking the pain medicine. And he's like, well, then why are you going to let me refer? There we go again. Why are we going to refer you to hospice if you're not going to take the medicine? He said, just so I can see what hospice offers. And hospice came. He kept them for 2 weeks, and he let them go. And for a whole year, he was fine. And then he got introduced back to hospice in July, exactly a year later, of 2025, and stayed in hospice for 8 days.
Yeah.
Came home on the 29th of July. and was well until the day he passed.
Yeah, I have to say one thing about Charles is he did everything on his terms.
Exactly. It's almost like the song that says, I did things my way.
Oh, my goodness.
And I know his children understand that more than anything.
True believer.
So I really am sorry for your all's loss. I mean, that's tough, losing your dad like that. And he was a dear man. He was just a dear, dear man. So tell me, like, in your all's relationship, what are some of the things that are just like diamonds? Like they call them diamond memories because they're those kind of things that you carry with you. Like, those are the things that your mind goes back to. For you guys, what are like some diamond memories for you all of your dad that you'd want to share?
The vacations.
Vacations. Okay.
The family vacations. That's what it started with him.
Yeah.
When they first picked me back up, it was just traveling, family reunions, just introduced me to the family, introduced me to my relatives and everything. And I took after that because that was some of the best memories.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, the number one memory I got, he had never let me live down, is that turd in Athens, Georgia.
Was what?
A turd.
Somebody took a nice little bowel release in the bathroom, and it stayed. And it's like, we all just, anytime we used to come together, we talk had to have a talk about that, because like, you don't get
because he had never seen a turd that big. He said something would come out of somebody big. He said that all, that was, he said that was like violating them.
I remember who said, he said, I had a question. I wonder if that man was, he said gay, but it was a different way he had said it. But it was like, wow, for something like that to come out of a man. Like, you, and we all just had our little own jokes about it.
Oh, my goodness.
I would never let that go. I cannot.
Well, his funny sense of humor, I could see that, right? That would just fit right in there. But the family vacations, like where did you guys go? Was it, did you travel around?
Myrtle Beach, Athens, Georgia.
I remember Athens.
Where else did we go? Y'all went to Gatlinburg not too long ago, right?
Yeah.
As a family.
That's cool. He really liked Gatlinburg, too. So.
Yeah, that was one of his faves.
Yeah. It's a lot of, yeah, a lot of people's faves. That's a great place down there. What about you, Amber? Not to put you on the spot, but you had a minute to think. So
I would say the time we went on vacation. It was me, him, Jamar, my girls, and my niece. And it was a good time. We was there for a week.
Yeah.
He got on my nerves a little bit, but it was a good time.
Yeah.
So what was some of y'all struggles with your dad?
Mine was, I ain't gonna say it's fear, but I couldn't talk to him. I never could come to myself to open up to him, to let him know how I feel or what's going on in my life, so he'd understand from outside what I was going through.
Yeah.
Like, most of the time when I call, it was waiting to check on him, make sure he's doing okay. I never wanted to call and put my burdens on him, or just, you see what I'm saying? And it's never to a point where I was strong enough to say, I need you to listen. So yeah. It was mainly, I wanted to just make sure my dad was doing okay. He never wanted for nothing. And like I said, that helped me get through my day.
Yeah.
And if he did ask for something, he know I'd be right there. So
yeah,
that was the main things. But most of the time most things I take from is coming over, watching movies, helping him hook up the fire stick, just getting certain things together.
Yeah. And I think you and I, and my husband, one night after everybody had left at hospice, we were just talking about complicated relationships with parents and how you can be completely different people as well as the relationship parent to child. It's just a different dynamic than, say, like my friendship with you or with you. It's just a very normal thing for it to be complicated, kids and parents at times. So. And I think Charles knew that. We actually touched on that a little bit about just how he missed some of your all's upbringing and how that was a regret. So what about you, Amber? I don't want to make you cry.
My struggles with him was the disappointments, the times he was supposed to come through and show up, he didn't. But instead of
reaching out, he cut me off. So the disappointment didn't come from him not showing up. It was from him backing off.
And that's hard. That's really hard when you're the kid and you have expectations of your parents. I mean, that's just a very normal thing. Were you guys able to like really talk that out, like in between his first hospice and his second?
I think I get this from my dad. I don't really talk things out. Like, I will vent to somebody about it, but talk personally with somebody about an issue, no. I'm okay with just coming back and we just, like, everything is normal. Like, just go back to the way it was.
It's almost like not addressing the gap.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like I'm just going to fill in the gap like it never happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how people protect themselves.
Yeah.
That's a protection mechanism. And I definitely know that your dad had that. That was how he protected himself.
Oh, yeah. Now, I did see that. I could see him push people away.
Oh, on every level. And that's why I want y'all to know this was not just about how he did it to you all. This was a behavior in all relationships, including with mine.
Yeah.
But she would see it.
Oh, yeah. I saw it a lot. Like, it was just in friends that he had and how strongly he would react. But then after he came out of hospice that first time, I did watch him try really very actively to reconcile those relationships and admit where he was wrong. And that blew my mind. But he was able, and I feel like it was a gift of God, but he was able to reconcile a lot of them. And I'm sorry that like, you guys weren't able to, like, talk that out.
I don't think that neither one of them wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we did.
Because she was there. She, right. After the hospice, actually inpatient hospice, his children were there every day.
Yeah.
And I think that they, again, all of them just, what I watched, and you can speak up, and, you know, both of you all, what I watched is them just trying to say to Charles, I'm here. You know, I don't know what to say outside of being here, but I'm here. And I think, Amber, you got a message from him, though, mm-hmm. on the 4th of September.
What?
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
It was playing phone tag, so he finally called me back, and he left me a message. I wasn't able to call him back, but he left me a message.
Was it like a, hey, I love you, daughter, mm-hmm. you're the apple of my eye kind of thing? What a thing to have. What a beautiful thing.
And that he wanted
to
get to, he pretty much was saying in that message, I'm forgive me, but I want to move forward in some new ways.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, well then that, I mean.
And Jamar, you had that experience too, right? He came to you, right? And what did he say to you?
As far as, like I said, we had our, give me a second.
Okay, no. I'm just saying, I know that you were part of that journey of asking for forgiveness or trying to make it right because y'all hadn't spoken.
Right, but we had so many instances, like I said. So he had called, and the first time he was just saying he apologized, that he definitely wanted to start over.
Yeah.
Like, we need to hit the reset, and everything that's in the past, we're going to leave in the past.
Yeah.
And from this day forward, that, like I said, in a sense, he's my dad. I'm his son. Like, I just, like, my selfishness, I'm still fighting it. So everything I heard from him, I accepted it. And I apologized for my shortcomings. But I still
held on.
I'm still, and that's the main thing, see. It's my choice of words. But I'm still holding on to the fact that that's my dad. And I wanted to be there. And I'm still going to be there.
Yeah,
and I'm still here, and that's the main thing. And but I appreciated him calling and apologizing.
Yeah,
because I'm not used to, I don't get a lot of apologies. I'm the one that's always apologizing, taking the step forward, and just trying to move on. And
I'm
trying to do better. I'm trying to do better.
Yeah, but the understandable part is
he's the parent.
You all are the children.
Yes,
and even as adult children, if you've had a wound from a father when you are younger, you still have that younger version of yourself until it can grow up and heal and catch up to where you are now. And sometimes it just takes time. And that's, and when I say that's not an indictment on your dad, like in any way, shape, or form, it's just the nature of parents and children. So that's just what I want to say, because we're all complicated. We all mess up. We all do things we don't mean to do. We try to make it up, but sometimes the healing from that can take a little time, and that's perfectly okay. So it's a heavy room right now.
I know, but it's okay. Heaviness is a part of healing.
Yeah.
You cannot heal unless you go heavy. You cannot heal if you don't go deep.
Yeah.
And we're not going to minimize the hurt and the pain that his that our children experienced, that Amber and Jamar experienced from from their father.
Which is totally
and
valid.
That's why we want to share this, because this is a part of his story, but this is also a part of his of other people's opportunity to heal.
Yeah.
And it's a part of you all's healing. And so it's all good is what I'm saying. It's heavy, but it's healing.
Yeah.
And
it's good to talk about it, because sometimes when you bury things, you're really just as sick as your secrets. Meaning if you don't bring things out into the light and deal with them, they're like angry kids that will just punch through at weird times, and you're like, why did I react that way? Well, because the little you is still trying to express what they're feeling.
Yes, so. And that's what part of embracing change is. If you see our logo, it talks, you see the grown up.
Yeah.
I've had this vision that when I created Embracing Change, that I wanted to show people how to start embracing their little people. Meaning that you grow up, but behind you will always be that little girl, little boy. But the difference is you get to lead them instead of them leading you.
Yep.
And I know from my experience for years, my little girl led me. And that's how I ended up in 20 years of prison and ended up in places of pain that I didn't want to be. I think in my husband's perspective, that's why he ended up having drug use and doing things, because his little boy was leading him. And I just, you know, through the process of 32 years of marriage and 33 years of working through his brokenness, I just think that it was only, he pivoted more in the last 7 weeks of his life than he ever had.
Yeah.
That's what I saw. And it was amazing, because marriage is hard work. So I know parenting is. But marriage is even harder. So when you got marriage and parenting together, I can only imagine what that's like. You know what I mean? Because that's DeLorean came on and talked about. Because DeLorean came on to talk about the fact of me not being the best parent to him in his very early years of his life.
Yeah.
So I had to sit here and hear it from his perspective, which he had never shared with me in that way. He was more open sitting here on this podcast about what it was like to learn to trust me again.
Yeah,
and to know that eventually when I stayed and I was willing to stay the course, he couldn't use his lack of trusting me as an excuse to disrespect me. And he realized that, and he had to accept that and own it. And he did. And he said, and then I had to learn how to respect the woman that she's becoming, and not the mother that she wasn't, but the mother that she is. And that took a paradigm shift for him.
Yeah.
You know, and he talked about his difficult times with Charles and all the things he had to go through as well, on how he had to learn to navigate him.
Yeah. One thing I love about Charles is in that period, he was really trying to work out things as much as he could. And to me, that's a gift, because
God gave him that.
He gave him
the 7 weeks. And I'm going to say, even 2 weeks ago on a Friday, 2 weeks ago today, we were in his room and we had an opportunity to have a mediation, I believe. And though Charles was not able to talk, I know he heard. But what I really saw that was a blessing for you all is that he couldn't run. Come on now. He couldn't run that day. He had to lay down and hear you all without moving. Mm. And to me, that was God.
Yeah.
That was the merciful Father that we have, that he set your father down in a space that all he could do was lay there, not open his mouth, not make excuses, but listen.
Yeah.
To me, if that is not a sovereign Lord, and you guys were able to express everything you felt
really
that day. Oh, they got naked and unashamed. And not that they, I would ask them to do it here, but they did it.
Yeah.
And they shared everything that it, how he hurt them and what they he did and how it made them feel.
Wow.
And he was able to hear that. And we could tell in moments. Remember in the room when he would make little noises because he couldn't speak at that time. He had went unresponsive. But he could hear us, and he would only respond to certain things, certain. But we would, they were talking and sharing how we were, and we did that for like 2 hours. We were the only ones in the room. Nobody else came because his room, the hospice people said they had never seen anyone have that many visitors.
Oh, gosh. I know one time I came in, it was so full. It was like there weren't even enough chairs.
Yeah, they had to bring more chairs.
Yes. It's like, my goodness.
But that showed even that, I think that that is what wanted Charles and your father to, I think he was fighting for his life. He wanted to come back.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just thank God, though, that you all had that time to share with him.
Yeah.
And he couldn't run. He couldn't respond. He couldn't make excuses. He just heard you all. That was a gift.
I can only compare it to when my father was dying and my father was in the ICU and he could not respond back to me. And one thing that I grew up really struggling with was being able to own my feelings, like to be able to say that I was angry at my dad. I couldn't do that because I didn't feel like I was entitled to feel like I felt. And my biggest epiphany was being able to say I was really mad at my dad. I was really mad at him, and it was okay for me to do that. So in the hospital room with him, I was able to tell him that. And that was such a freeing moment for me to be able to say to my dad, I forgive you. I forgive you. Because I believe, even with like your dad, of course, he could hear everything you said. I think my dad could hear everything I said. And that in and of itself is a gift too, because there are lots of people that don't get that opportunity to mm-hmm. say those final things that they want to say, to be really real and vulnerable with their feelings. And it takes a certain amount of bravery too on your all's part. So well done there. I mean, that's hard though. How did you guys come out of that? Like, what were your thoughts after you had those moments with your dad? And if you don't want to talk about it, like I said, you're free to say pass.
I'm just working on my words.
But yeah. You got words. And like,
of course, but as they come out wrong. I told
it,
you,
they
I,
don't, there's
I'm
no
trying
wrong.
Trying to speak and
I'm
not
saying,
rush.
I know.
I got this. I got okay. this.
I'm like, there's no wrong ways to speak.
No. And it's complicated. Everything is complicated. So sometimes it's not so clear.
I grew up not being judgmental. So when I was, I guess I used to judge my dad because how he used to come at me, I used to feel like I always did something wrong. So at that, like I said, at the time, just sitting in there, just seeing him in his state where he was, I'd never seen that before. And that being my dad, I had to take, I was literally trying to, I wanted to take the pain off of him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was to the point where everything I thought about, even when I was 18, 19, we had a little falling out. Then we had another falling out at the age of 36, 37. And I'm just thinking about how much hate I was trying to put in my heart for him.
Yeah.
And it was just something that told me it's going to kill you just like it took him out. And it's to a point where I didn't want to go through the rest of my life holding on to stuff that I really don't have no control over.
Yeah.
And that's my biggest thing was I don't have control over everything that he did, only things that I've done. And then I had to make a choice that I still want to be here. I want to be around my mom. And I definitely want to get closer to my sister. But it's to the point where I shelter myself because I feel like that was the best place for me.
Yeah.
I can protect myself when I don't have to worry about nobody else trying to bring me down.
Yeah.
And that's all I had coming up through our relationships. like I said, it was the point in time when he told me he didn't want to be another one of my girlfriends. Broke me. But it's still a certain time, like, I still have to live my life. So I just have to choose wisely of the women I feel I'm going to bring in my life.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where I don't even share that with the outside. Not my mom. Nobody knows who I'm dating or who I'm talking to. And that's how I felt like I was protecting myself. But in reality, it was really going to hurt me. Because, like I said, I need these voices to help people. Me when I'm falling off track.
Yeah.
So.
We all need community. All of us. The Bible said it's not good for man to be alone. And he ain't talking about marriage and relationships. He's talking about connection to human relations. Because he caused us to be able. We are his greatest resource. All of us. We are wealthy in this room. Because all of us come to this moment with so many gifts. And you put those gifts together, unstoppable.
Yeah. So Amber, what were you thinking coming out of that room?
My relationship with my dad wasn't like my brother. He didn't come into my life until I was grown, like an adult.
You were like 30, wasn't you?
No, I was in my 20s still. Okay.
Did you know about him before that point and who he was?
I knew of him. I remember him coming around at the church and at the house and stuff like that, but couldn't put a face to him.
Hmm.
So how we got in touch was my aunt and my sister was at the casino, and he was at the casino, and my aunt told my sister, that's Amber dad. And then my sister's like, no, it ain't. And then she walked over there, and they spoke, and then he asked for my number. And my sister was like, I'll take yours, because they know not to give nobody my number. I'm the mean sibling. I'm the mean one.
She's a straightforward one.
Yeah.
Well, that's good though. You don't mince words is what you're saying, basically.
So she called me or whatever, and I was like, okay. So I gave him a call, and he was bringing up, it kind of made me feel some type of way, because he was bringing up, how he used to drive past the house when I was little and watch me playing. And he brought up how when I worked at McDonald's, he used to come and order stuff from me and didn't say nothing.
And you had no idea.
Yeah. And I'm like, and I knew he wasn't lying, because he knew things about me that only way he would know if he was actually there. And I didn't say anything, but in my head, I'm like, so why didn't you say something? Like, why didn't you make yourself notice? Mm. And he said he carried my baby picture around in his wallet, and he do with my name and birthday and everything on it. So when we were talking or whatever, he would just keep bringing up the past about my family or whatever. And I said, hey, I'm an adult now. I make my own decisions. If you want to be in my life, we're going to start from this day forward. We're not going to talk about the past.
Amen.
Like, I'm willing to give you a chance, but we're going to leave the past in the past. And he understood that. But after that conversation, he went ghost. If it was for my mom, my stepmom reaching out to me every time, she was the mediator that reached out. So I always felt like I was closer to her than I was to him. Because and every time he would come around, it was like what I got out of it was like he didn't want to be there. He was forced to be there. If it wasn't for her, he wouldn't be here. So, and I would never, ever, ever force anyone to be in my life. But one thing you're not going to do is walk in and out of my life.
Yeah.
So, I told him, so when he talked to me again, he brought up his cancer. And I wasn't trying to be cold-hearted. I said, cancer don't give you an excuse to act the way you acted.
Well,
I said, cancer is terminal. That's a terminal illness. You know, anything, any day you can leave. So you need to make things right.
Yeah.
I said, I'm not. He was like, but Amber, the phone worked both ways. I said, I'm not your daddy.
Come on.
I'm your daughter. I'm not chasing you.
Right.
And I told him, I said, I grew up in a loving household or whatever. We didn't have riches and money. I didn't, you know, but we always a home cooked meal. We always had a roof over our head and everything else. I said, I was never the child that wanted to go on Maury looking for my dad. I said, yeah. I was raised in a home where I didn't have a dad. It wasn't a big deal to me. My grandpa was my dad. My uncles was, that was my dad. They showed up. So I was excited when he came into my life. Like, okay, I got a real dad. I could be a daddy's girl or whatever. But every time he was supposed to show up for something, not even me asking anything of him, it was something he would bring up. And then he couldn't show up. He would just disappear. And I'm like, one time, it went like a year or something, that my mom reached out about his birthday.
His 70th birthday party.
Mm-hmm. Would you come to dinner for his birthday? And I was like, yeah, because I don't have any hate in my heart. I don't hate nobody. Like, I just don't talk to you. And I know this is bad.
No, it's not. It's your feelings.
For anybody, like, I love hard. Like, so if I call you my friend or anything, that's what you are. I don't call everybody my friend. I love hard. So I'm going to keep giving you chance and chance and chance until I can't give you another chance. Like, yeah. I feel like I've done all I can do, and I'm done. So when I hit that point, there's no coming back. I have a funeral for you in my head, so it's over with. And this is how I work through my problems. If I fall out with someone and I think about them, and I think about them passing, if I don't have an emotion about it, it's not meant for me to reach out to you. I'm over that season. But I didn't have that for my, I didn't have those feelings for my dad. He would be petty, but he forgot that his blood runs through my veins and I'm petty too. He forgot who I was. So I'm,
you come by it honest.
Yeah.
We're going to go toe to toe with it.
That's like, right. If this is what you want to do, my dad knew he couldn't talk to me crazy. He couldn't do nothing. I would not allow it. You got the right one. No. And you came in my life way too late in my life to think you about to mistreat me and make me feel any type of way. But he did. It was a lot of times where we went a long time without talking. And I'm stubborn. I know I am. So I wouldn't reach out. Sometimes I would reach out. But a lot of times I didn't, because I was like, you're the one that disappointed me. This is your fault. Why am I reaching out for you? Mm-hmm. But that was just our relationship. We never had a conversation about it or anything. It just, when he would make the phone call, I'd make the phone call, we'd just go about our day like just regular, because I didn't hold any grudges towards him or anything. I would be mad at him and I'd be like, I don't care, I ain't talking to him or whatever. Like, I never wanted anything to happen to him.
Right.
I never thought, in my mind, I never thought like, okay, this might be his last day. That was never a thought in my mind, to be like, okay, Amber, reach out, because I honestly didn't care. I'm sorry. But
it's your feelings. It's all right. It's all right.
But whenever we talked, we just moved on like nothing ever happened. And I was okay with that.
Yeah, you were able to let all that go. Yeah.
But that day when you were able to share how you felt and he was laying in that bed, did that release you to some level?
I don't know, because I don't feel like I was holding any resentment or anything. Okay. The only thing that bothers me is the relationship he has with everyone else. I didn't get to see that side.
Okay.
All the stories I hear how good of a person he was and everything, I didn't really get. I seen it, but not for a long time. My biggest problem was, I was like, okay, if he can't be active as a dad, he can make it up to his grandkids.
Right.
And that was one of our biggest falling out, because we did go out of town. And when we got back from the trip, he didn't talk to me. And I didn't know why. Like, he stopped talking to me and I didn't understand. And the girls was excited to spend more time with him. And they thought this was going to be a yearly thing. And it wasn't. So that was my last straw. You can play with my feelings. You're not going to play with my kids' feelings.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not going to allow that. So, but every chance I got, I let him know, we're not doing this. And either he would talk to me, or that would be a reason for him to stop talking to me again. I'd be like, okay, that's the decision you chose to make.
So I want to ask you a question. You can, again, totally pass on this. Was it hard for you meeting him as an adult and having the expectation of a daughter and a father relationship when you didn't really know him? Like, was that a hard thing? Like,
I didn't have any expectations.
That's good.
Yeah. I did not have an expectation of being his daughter or him being my father.
That's good.
Again, because that was not something I felt like I was lacking in my life. It was just me going to meet this person that's supposed to be my dad, and I'm his daughter. And we had more of a friendly relationship, like, because we can joke and talk and everything else. So when you don't, no expectations, no disappointments.
Oof. And one of the things she said in the first meeting on Mother's in May, when we first met at Longhorn, and I'll never forget that. I was like, ooh, wee, that hurt me. And I mean, I can only imagine how he felt. You know, he was like, well, where do we go from here? And you looked at him, you said, I ain't had a daddy for 30 years. So, like, for real, though, what do you mean? I ain't have none. I don't need none. So, what? Yeah. And I was like, ooh, wee. And I know that hurt him. Like, I know that for him that day, just some of the things he felt was like, how do you move from that? You know, she's grown and I don't really see her wanting a relationship with me, and I'm not going to force myself on her either. You know what I mean? And so it's like, and I remember he didn't really say anything to you that day when you said it. He just looked at y'all. We took a few pictures and we dispersed. And it's like... But I know that it hurt him. And I think, Jamar, what you experience is you experience some of that aggression, I believe, as a projection, especially once he met Amber. I do believe that you got a lot of what Amber was able to handle him in her way. But then I would watch Charles when he would fall out with Amber, how he would attack you. I really would.
I see.
I really would. Ooh. I would see how he would, now the person he felt like he had control over, he would project that onto Jamar. And I would, just like I did with you and him, I would interject. You know what I mean? But I was not there a lot of times when he would find those spaces to do that to Jamar. And Jamar not choosing to close his mouth, I wouldn't know he was doing it. I just would know that Jamar would disappear. So I already knew when he disappeared that Charles had did something.
I didn't know that.
Oh, he took a lot out on Jamar, Amber, based on you and his relationship. Because he had no control for you, over you. And you and him, the way you handled you and protected yourself, he then attacked Jamar. Because Jamar was the child that he felt like he was the father to. And so now, because you're rejecting me, I'm going to reject him. And I watched it on many levels. Ooh-wee. I saw the dynamics, and I would say that to him and deal with him about it.
So it wasn't rejection on my part. I didn't say it that day in the restaurant. I mean, I meant what I said.
I know.
The ball is in your court. Either you want to be in my life or you don't. I'm okay either way. So it wasn't rejection for me. Communication will fix a lot of problems. And I know I'm really bad at communicating. But
as are most people, I'm just going to say, communication is a learned thing.
And I don't like confrontation. So if I feel like something that I'm going to say is going to cause a confrontation, I'm going to just shut up. Unless I'm mad, then it's over. You're going to hear everything I got to say. But I feel like if we did have a conversation, it could have been better because I wasn't rejecting him. I guess he, like you said, he felt
that was his feelings. Rejection. It doesn't mean,
no, I wanted you here. So in my head, so I guess we both felt like we was rejecting each other because in my head, you was rejecting me. Mm-hmm. And in your head, I was rejecting you. But again, I'm the child. You had me.
Right.
And that will never change. He's the adult.
So,
right. Yeah, but then he would then it was like they call this in therapy kick the doll syndrome. And so if he felt kicked by you, then he would go kick Jamar. He would literally go kick Jamar. And I watched it and it was like, "Charles, what are you doing?" "No, you don't understand." "Yeah, I do understand. I saw it. And I understand that you feel like that about Amber, but this Jamar didn't do anything to you."
But his feelings,
for me is for stuff that he did.
I understand. Yeah. No, yeah, it's, no, I'm just, yeah, it, all of it was, but this is the what we're talking about in this moment is the dysfunction of tragedies, right, and trauma.
Yeah, that's, you know what exactly I mean? It.
And then triggers. So it was all of that was happening, so we couldn't really get to the level of truth, because your dad didn't always want to listen to the truth. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't get to the level of trust. So we never got to the level of living triumphantly as a whole family. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And yes, I was going to always do the right thing, because to know better is to do better. And I had done the work. So I knew what it was like. But I also lived with this man that I loved and that I know loved me the best he could with what he had. So it was my responsibility as first a child of God to know the word of God and to live by the word of God, to do whatever I could to reconcile us as best I could. And even I heard when you said that he felt like he was drugged, I'm going to say no, it may have looked that way, but let me tell you what you were seeing, Amber. You were seeing regret, and you were seeing awkwardness. Because never once that we invited you to something that he didn't want to come. Not one time. Charles, your dad was just as stubborn as you was. I went to lots of events, and Jennifer can attest to this, major events in my life that he didn't show up for. You hear what I'm saying? So this wasn't just a y'all issue. This was a him issue. It wasn't a us issue. It was a him issue. I can name them like right now that I was standing alone because he refused to show up for me. And I don't know if it was because it was about me or because he didn't know how to show up, or he didn't want to live in my shadow, or I don't know what it was, but I'm looking at pictures to put in his obituary. And there was a lot of events that I had that I was standing there by myself. My 60th birthday party.
And he was not there. I had a conversation with him about that. I was trying to give him the comfort.
You know what I'm saying? But he wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I'm saying there's so many things that I did in life that blessed us both, that made me know that this wasn't personal anymore, that this was about his issues. So I got to a point where I quit asking him to attend, because I didn't, honestly, like you, I stopped caring, because I'm not going to sit and put myself in a position to be rejected when I know rejection is part of the enemy's playground for me, because my mother gave me away. You heard our story, me and my sister's story. So I couldn't keep on putting myself in the posture to be rejected by Charles. And so I chose at the WOW to quit inviting him. And then all of a sudden, when I would start inviting him, I would say, when we were doing stuff, I would say, this is what we're getting ready to do. Do you want to go? It wasn't about me and him, this is what we going to do. No, I have invited Amber and him to do that, you know, Christmas dinner, da, da, da. Are you wanting to go? Because he had an option to say no, and we would have all did it. You know what I mean? So I just want you to know that every time he showed up, it wasn't out of being drugged. It was out of because he wanted to, but I think it was the awkwardness of what he failed to do. Because you feel bad about what you failed to do. You feel guilty, you feel shame, you feel, what do I really say? Because nobody I used to say this and I still say it, in the darkness, when nobody's looking but you in the mirror, you know who you truly are. You know what you truly have done. You know what you haven't done, and you know what you could do. The question is, will you do it? And not all of us are able. No, we're able. We're not willing. And so I just know that I have internal information that you all don't have, because I had to go toe-to-toe with him on a whole nother level. And yeah. So, but I would see the times he would interact with you and then how he would treat him. And then he would shut down and stay away, not call nobody.
And right. Don't answer
text. Don't answer his text. Don't do nothing. So then he would reject. So it was a spirit of rejection and abandonment that we were all, that you all were struggling with, the three of you all. You just didn't know how to articulate it or communicate about it.
And I would even challenge that it, I don't think it was a not caring, like after a while. I think it was probably like, I'm not going to put myself out here to get hurt. So I'm going to pull back and I'm going to put up my wall. Because I think it, if you truly didn't care, you would just have a different feeling about it. And because I think truly deep down, you want the acceptance, you want the relationship, you want the things, of course. So it's easier to put up the wall and step back than to put yourself out there and get kicked, right?
I do that in my everyday life.
Well, that's a normal thing.
It's
natural.
It's called, you know, we fight, flight, or, you know, it's either fight or flight. You know, and some of us fight and flight. We do both. You know what I'm saying? But it's all a protection mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially for kids and parents. You know, kids don't bear the responsibility the parents do. Mm-hmm. The kids are brought into the world, and the parents are really supposed to watch out for a kid, right? That
we're responsible to, right. As the parent, we're responsible.
But people mess up all the time.
Well, because they depend on how they were parented,
right?
And so if they're broken people break people, and hurt people hurt people.
Amen. It's just, that's true.
And until we heal people heal people. And I still will go back to that day 2 weeks ago. That was the relinquishing and the hearing that he heard y'all, and there was nothing he could do. And like you said, Jamar, but listen, but the other thing, he couldn't retaliate. That was y'all's moment. God gave that to you all. He couldn't reject it. He couldn't
argue with it.
He couldn't, right. He couldn't run from it. Do you see what I'm saying? We have to look at situations and say, Lord, if I ever ask you for something, did you ever give it to me? That day, I felt like he gave it to y'all. And you gutted out your feelings. He heard you. Because like they say, through death, the last thing that goes is hearing.
It's the hearing, yes.
And so God had to lay your dad out for him in his final few days to be for him to hear all of us. Because there were times I had to say things to him that he didn't want to hear. But I was able to say everything I wanted to say to him during those 7 days. Everything.
Yeah.
Even thanking him. Let me say this to you all. I was able to say to him, I know that you felt like you lived in my shadow. But you live next to me. Mm-hmm. I am who I am because of you. Whether you took on the identity of that or not, Charles, you were the one who was able to come into my life for 32 years and heal so many pieces of me that nobody else got to do. And God chose you to heal me. And for that, I'm grateful. Am I disappointed on things that we could have did different? Yes, I am. But I'm grateful for what you did do in my life. I hadn't had a chance to really say those things in that kind of level to him until he was laid out like that. And every day there was a part of me, and you saw me, thinking that he was going to get back up. Looking at the thought of, should I do this? Or should I do that? Is this the time? Like, should I make, you know, I'm going to take him, you heard me, I'm going to take him home. I'm taking him off all the medicine. And you had to talk me down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it was like,
okay, LaCreta, back up.
Because no, I wanted to make sure that he wasn't being over-medicated and that his medication was not causing his condition.
Yeah.
Until the Lord spoke to me and said, no, he's in the labor room. And he's coming back to me. He's not going home. This is it. So posture yourself for it. And even that night when I thought, and you came, when I thought that Monday night was going to be it. Like, when we stayed up with him all that overnight to Tuesday morning.
Right.
Not knowing that we still only had a little less than 24 hours. But I knew it was coming. I knew it in my knowing. I just didn't know when, but I thought it was that night. So I'm just saying, we all, I know for me, I can't speak for you, but for me, I had many days and nights in them 7 days to share with my husband and my friend. And my friend. As much as he got on my nerves, as much as he disappointed me, I know he loved me in the way that he could. And he showed up for me in the way that he could. And for that, I will ever be grateful. Forever grateful. And that's when people are asking me, how are you doing? All I say is, I'm grateful. I'm going to miss him, but I'm grateful. We're going to get through this. And we're going to be better because of it. Because he has left us something. He left us each other.
Yeah. And what I can say out of that, out of this whole conversation, is talk to the people you love. Be vulnerable with the people you love. Say the things you need to say. Work out the things you need to work out, because you really don't know what is around the corner. I mean, I've heard that so many times that it's been kind of a cliche, like, oh yeah, right, say what you need to say. But no, really.
I mean, well, we experienced that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we have walked through it now. We know it to be true.
Yeah.
See, other people, it's a cliche, but we now know it's a truth.
It's a truth.
Because yep. We did not see this coming. And that same day he went into hospice, he was at work that same day. You know what I mean? His last meal was in this building, a turkey sandwich. You know what I mean? That just, he was washing his clothes.
He was a strong man. You know what
I
mean? Man.
So I'm just saying that.
Gosh.
I don't think he saw it either.
Yeah.
But there was something about it that night when it happened. And he said, I've got to get out of this house. He made this comment when he called me, and he said, if I had a gun, I'd shoot myself right now. That's how much pain I'm in. And I remember thinking, what? And he's like, where are you? And I was like, I'm at the BMV. And he's like, when are you coming home? Because I need that pain medication. I need somebody, call the nurse, you know. And he was screaming. And it was so, I'd never seen anything like it. And when I got there, he was somebody different. I just had never seen it. I had to walk out the room because his aggression was so hard. But now I know it was the pain he was in. And it came on so suddenly.
Yeah.
As we know it. I don't know if it came suddenly. My question still is, at times, had you been in pain all this time, but determined to do things in the way you did them?
I would almost guess yes, because he was so strong-willed about, like, the medication and everything. And when it finally hit that point where he couldn't tolerate it anymore, like, that was it. Like, he was in hospice, and later that night, it seemed like he kind of just went into himself.
Well, because he went in on that Wednesday night, and he was fine. As fine could be, he was conscious and talking and joking, calling me the fake doctor. You know, like, are you? What's that thing you put around your neck?
Stethoscope.
Yeah, where's your stethoscope? What, you the fake doctor? I mean, can you just go get the doctor, the real doctor? Because you know, you something he was saying. I would say, Charles, be quiet. And he was like, because I want to take a shower. Because I ain't going to sleep without no shower. I said, you are medicated. You ain't no doctor. He kept saying to me, you ain't no doctor. You the fake doctor.
I could see him saying that.
Oh, no, he was serious. You know, he's like, I need to talk to the real people that went to nursing school and doctor school, because you ain't go to doctor school. You know what I mean? And he didn't, you know, I was like, whatever. So, you know, that night he took a shower. You know, I told him I wasn't going to stay there that night. I said, I'm not staying in this hospital like I did last time. I'm going home. He took that shower, came back the next day, and I'm telling you, he took his medication. He was still fussing about that medication, wasn't going to take it. Then, like, they gave him this purple pill, and he's like, What's that pill? What's that purple pill? And they said, that's a stool softener, Mr. Bowman, because you're taking this medication. We don't want you to get, you know, stopped up, you know, so we're giving you a stool softener with it. I didn't ask for no stool softener. Y'all sure? I don't think I'm going to take it. No, just take that medication away. And I was like, so and then he looked at me and Damien, and his mom was there, and he looked at us. He said, advise me. What should I do? And we said, take the medicine. And I'm telling you, he took it. We all said, you know, he Damien and him left, and then I left. And I have a picture of him on the side of when he was. I said, Charles, try to get some rest. I said, because I don't think you've slept. They told me you was up 3 or 4 times last night to use the bathroom, that you really didn't sleep with all that medication you was on. Because when we were home, they gave him 20 milligrams of morphine, 40 milligrams of oxycodone before we even went to hospice. Just to see, they call it a breakthrough pain, to see if they could get the pain reduced, even in your consciousness. And it didn't. And that's when they said, no, bring him in, because we have got to get that pain managed. And when he got there, he said, I don't want morphine. And they said, well, what do you want, Mr. Bowman? You know, because he's his own doctor, too. you know, he's the pain managing doctor. And so they said, well, what would you like, Mr. Bowman? He said, give me Dilatus. He said, I think that that would work better for me. And so they did. They only gave him 4 milligrams, 2 milligrams, very small dosage. And he still didn't go to sleep. And then, like I said, the next day, the doctor encouraged him to take a few more doses, like a higher milligram. And that's where he was fighting that. And so he took the higher milligram. And then that day, when I got back from, I went to my meeting, he told me he loved me, threw me a kiss. I said, kiss, give me a kiss. And he's like, and gave me the kiss, like whatever he could do. I said, Charles, get some rest. I said, I'll be back in about 4:30. He said, and I'll be here. When I got back, Charles never woke back up. He never became conscious. That's the night he threw up. That's the night. When I got back, they said that they called it terminal agitation. They said he had wrestled in that bed for 3 hours, meaning he was going up the bed, then he was coming down the bed. And they was like, Mr. Bone, we need you to put your head back up. And they, about the third time, they just said, you know, we're not going to bother him because he's getting irritated every time we do it. And they said, they hair up and told me as soon as they saw me, I want you to know, we did not put him in the bed like this. He got down here like it's on his own.
That was funny when I walked in and I saw his head at the feet and his feet at the head. I was like, what is going on here? And he wasn't conscious at all.
Yeah, he wasn't talking.
No. Except when you wiped his eyes.
He would wake up.
Mm-hmm. He woke up and he
just looked at me.
He said something not real kind, but yeah.
Being his typical self.
He did. He was just like, get off.
Yeah.
She was just trying to wipe his eyes after he'd thrown up in the throat. Oh, that was terrible.
Sat all the way up in the bed to do that.
He totally did. And that
which was shocking. Like, he sat all the way up and he held it. He held it until I got the garbage can for him to do it. And then he laid down and I was wiping his mouth and he said, get off of me or something. He said,
yeah.
And I said, shut up. Again, shut up.
Charles, she's trying to wipe your face.
And that was the last words I heard from him. You know, he never spoke again. And y'all know the story from there. It was just...
Although one time somebody said his name, I think it was Elvin, probably the next time I came. And she said, Charles, and he opened his eyes and said...
I mean, he would do that.
What?
Oh, he was doing that. He was doing that a lot, you know what I'm saying?
But then he never, said anything else.
Yeah, so. When we call his name, he would, that's why we know he could hear us.
Right.
Because he would open his eyes. And so, but the end result is that he went peaceful. He breathed so hard. I was like, it's a sound. Like
it was hard to live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was fighting to not go either.
Yeah.
You know, but it was a hard breathe. I mean, that breathing, that sound was like, oh my God, this, and it made us feel like he was in such pain.
Like we was ready for him to just go ahead and transition. Yeah. It seemed like it was just harder to live than just to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. This whole thing was like watching someone struggle between heaven and earth, mm-hmm. and wrestling, like his spirit wanted to just be out of his body, but his body wouldn't let him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. I mean, it just was such a weird thing to watch somebody walk through. I can't say that I've ever seen that. I mean, I just never had. And it is hard to watch someone that you know and love to go through something like that. It's just, it's super complicated.
Yeah. But, not but, and I just, you know, for me, I just want to, like I said, thank the listeners, but I also want to thank Charles. You know, this is a tribute to him, to the 32 years of our marriage, the 30 years of ministry. Today is my last day, and you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
today
my gosh,
is my last day.
We
had planned, you know, trips, because I'm retiring today from the ministry that we founded. I will still oversee a lot of pieces of it, but from as a coaching and consulting versus a day-to-day operation person. And we had plans, and God had better plans for him. And so as I end this chapter and begin a new one, I've got to trust that the next one is going to be as good as the first one.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you've had a lot of transition in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And still transitioning through mm-hmm. some stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we always think it's tomorrow. Because when I got the call, I don't know if you called me or DeLorean called me first. And he was like, hey, sis, Charles on his way back to hospice. Because
it was DeLorean.
DeLorean called me first. Okay. A lot of people don't know. I couldn't come up there because I was with Myla, because I had to take her to have emergency surgery.
Oh. Her daughter.
Yeah. So, and again, I was thinking like it was in July, I would go up there every day to see him. He was talking, joking, capping on people and everything. So in my head, I'm like, it's okay. Tomorrow I'll be up there to see him. He'll talk to me or whatever. But when I got there, he was already unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, so I was salty about that. So again, I'm thinking like, he gonna wake up. We all thinking he gonna wake up.
Right.
And I was there Friday to Tuesday when I didn't get to come back that Tuesday.
No, we was
Tuesday,
there Tuesday. We went to
Wednesday dinner. Yeah, we did go to dinner.
He passed at 2:00 in the morning of that Wednesday. You were there always to then.
Friday, I was there when, Friday, I think I did like a 10-hour shift there. And that 10-hour, within that 10-hour shift, you can just see the decline.
Come on.
Like, because he was breathing hard. His breathing changed. You just seen the decline. It was hard to watch, but I was happy that I was there. Because I wanted him to know that I was there and that I loved him and I forgave him and everything was going to be okay.
Yeah.
It was hard. It's hard to watch somebody you love go through something like that.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
I did wish that I would have made it a day sooner so he could see that I was there, because the voice message that he called and said, he was like, I just want to hear your voice.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I made sure I was there every day by his side.
Sure was.
But when we talked to him, he would open up his eyes. Like, when I did get up there Friday, he was moving his hands and mm-hmm. stuff. But he just couldn't talk. He was opening his eyes. He was making noises. But within Friday, the whole time I was there, it just, like, slowly...
Declined.
Mm. Like, but for me, to help me heal, I knew I had to be there. Like I was in July, I knew I had to show up.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And that first night, I mean, like you said, you couldn't be there because your daughter needed you.
Yes.
I mean, and she's okay and everything. Yeah, thank goodness. Thank goodness. But yeah. Oh, yeah.
Jamar came the same night.
Of course. I wasn't going to miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Him and DeLorean came that same night when he got there. And he was different even that night, don't you think? Or no? Or he was this jovian self?
No, I think he was still his self when we got there.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was the next day. It was the transition going down, but I don't remember. Like I said, because when I came in, everybody was making jokes. And I forgot who he's talking to.
But he was aware at that point?
I'm talking about the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, the first time.
You mean this time or July or now?
I'm talking about July.
Okay.
Yeah, July.
Yeah, July was nothing like this recent time.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of July. He wanted his hair cut, everything.
I know.
Up at Christ, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when you came to Blue Ash, you came the same day they went in, the mm-hmm. day of Blue Ash, you and DeLorean came. Mm-hmm. You know.
Because I think he got up, you see, it was like 6. I think we got there.
Yeah, because like he got there about 6:30. Y'all got there about 7:15 or something like that. But, you know, he declined quickly. He did. It transitioned so quick. And so for me, I was grateful that God didn't have him suffer for weeks on end.
Oh my goodness.
You know, but it was a moment, and I'm telling you, I felt like the whole time he was laboring into his rest.
Wow.
And he was just not willing to go really easy.
Yeah, I was like, he holding on to something. I asked, did everybody say what they needed to say to him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because he was holding on to something. He was holding on for something.
Yep.
He was strong. I mean, really, when you think about it, like, he defied what the doctors thought because mm-hmm. he started juicing and eating healthy. And he wouldn't take pain medication when the hospice came the first
Emperor
time.
Emperor introduced him to a lot of that healthy eating.
Oh my goodness. Like it, yeah. I think that was why he lived as long as he did, as healthy as he did. And I think this last time it was like his strength couldn't break through, or the pain broke through his strength, maybe mm-hmm. is a better way to put it. And that it was just, his body just,
and that's what they kept
anymore.
Telling me. They's like, Miss Bowman, this is not the medication. This is, we're not even giving him medication every 8 hours. This is part of the dying process. And I kept saying, what?
Because she thought it was he was in this state because he was medically induced. So I had to tell her, like, no, he's not medically induced. They need to give him the medicine so he can relax, so he can transition. Because he was not taking medicine. So he was in pain. And they said, as long as he's in pain, his body is going to fight. So mm-hmm.
they sure did.
So we had to up his medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when his cancer came back in 2017, that's actually when we got back close. Mm-hmm. Because I worked at my last job when he came into my life. So it was like 2011, 2012. It was not that long after
he was diagnosed.
So 2016, we'll talk a little bit, but 2017, when it came back, that's when me and him got closer, and then COVID and stuff came. So I had him doing the sea moss and the elderberry mm-hmm. and the teas and stuff, and every time he goes to the doctor, he called me like, they don't believe, I told them, these teas, they don't believe, my numbers went down. I told them, I was like, for every pill, there's a plant. So
mm-hmm.
and he stuck to it.
He did. That was the most consistent thing besides, I mean, he'd done a lot of consistent, but that was so consistent. His eating, his juicing, his, you know, telling, he became the doctor to everybody else, you know.
But it worked.
It did.
Oh my gosh.
It did.
I really think that's why he was able to survive as long as he did after that. I mean, I really think his diet had a lot to do with it.
I honestly forgot that his cancer came back because he did not move like it. He didn't act like it or anything.
I'm telling you, everybody right now that knew Charles, and I'm sharing with them that he's gone, there is like, they have a heart attack? What's wrong? What happened? And I said, no, he had cancer. You kidding me? You know what I mean? He never did look like he had, you know.
Right? Well, he was so strong, like you said. He worked here the Wednesday that he then went into hospice this mm-hmm. last time. And it's like, holy cow, people didn't believe it when I said, well, yeah, he went into the hospital or into hospice that night. I was talking to somebody here and they were like, no way. I just saw him and he stopped by my office and we just chatted. And
like Diana, he had said, that was Diana. Yeah. He was telling her about his family and he was telling her how much he appreciate us. And I walked in on it. He said, and you know that LaCrita, she never ceases to amaze me. She always make it you know, even with my family, she always make it right. It's, you know, like, I'm going to have to, what did he, I walked in, I'm going to have to make sure she knows, you know, her birthday is Friday, you know, because it was that Wednesday. And he's like, her birthday is Friday. I got to make sure she know that I really appreciate her. Yeah. And I was like, okay, what you going to do? And he's like, dang, I didn't know you was standing there, you know.
Oh, that's
but
so
what
funny.
People forget is he was already under hospice care. Mm-hmm. That was his sixth week going into hospice. He was everybody take him off of hospice.
Yeah, they was on the 22nd was his last day because he was doing so well.
Yeah, it's such an amazing thing. I really feel like that period was a miracle.
He just went back in the residential hospice, but he was under hospice care those 6 weeks.
Yeah,
as they was monitoring him.
It was an amazing thing. Yeah, we had an opportunity to really talk about that when he sat down here about like just what a miracle that was. And what was so funny is that first time him coming out of hospice, the nurse was trying to not console, but warn Lucretia, like, well, you know, this happens, you know, they rally and it 24, 48 hours. So don't, you know, like, don't get your hopes up kind of thing. And then a week goes by and then another week and it's like, yeah, this isn't a rally. I really believe this is a miracle of God.
That's what the nurse even said. She said, I usually don't talk spirituality with my patients because I try to respect everybody's belief, but I know y'all are believers and I'm telling you, God has given him a miracle.
Yeah.
And even when she came, remember she came to see him and Autumn, she came to see him. And when she came to see him, she saw me out in the parking lot and she said, we were just talking about Mr. Bowman she came on that Saturday, I think. And she said, we was just talking about him in our team meeting on Friday and said, he was the longest rally call, if that's what it was, that we had ever experienced in hospice.
Yeah, it wasn't a rally call. It was a miracle.
And
I firmly believe that.
And we are grateful for the miracle as we prepare to lay him to rest. We are, you know.
Is there anything that you guys would want to say in closing, either about your dad or to just somebody out there who's going through the same sort of thing? I'll let you pick, but is there anything you'd want to say in closing?
As you know, I definitely truly love him and he definitely will be missed.
Yeah,
he will be missed. All his jokes he cracked and everything else. He knew how to lighten the mood.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he couldn't drive for nothing, but he was definitely always my Uber driver to the airport.
Yeah, he enjoyed that. He's like, I'm taking Amber to the airport. She called me.
Uber driver to the airport.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh.
So I think I would say we thank you, Charles.
Yeah.
For what you gave us and what we will always live with. I do anyway. I thank you for the love and for the time.
Yeah.
And I thank God for the loan because he was only loaned to us.
Yeah. He left an indelible mark.
He did. He will.
Yeah,
and
for
he
sure.
will always be that. And now we get to write the next chapter of the story.
Yeah, I'm thankful because these last 7 weeks not only taught me about my dad, but taught me about myself. Like, because a lot of me is him. Like, we're alike in a lot of ways. So, I was grateful for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how you may be raised without a parent. And then you realize how much you're like them.
Parent.
Oh my gosh. I look at myself. I wasn't raised with my mother. And I will sometimes look at myself in the mirror and think, oh my gosh, I look just like my mom right there.
I look just like
she looked just like her dad.
Yeah.
And Jamar has a lot of his mannerisms.
It's funny how that happens. Like, oh man, your genetics, like they just follow. They just follow for
they
sure.
Follow you.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. That's so great. Well, yes, Charles, thank you for everything, sir. And with that, we're going to wrap up this episode.
Amen.
Amen.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne.
podcast copyright 2025 by Lakrita Bowman.